From the Moon Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. Good morning. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle. Coming up, our critics review Spider-Man Far From Home, starring Tom Holland and Zendaya. Midsommar, a horror mystery from writer-director Ari Aster, who wrote and directed the critically acclaimed 2018 film Hereditary. And we'll party like it's 1599 and talk about Shakespeare in movies. It's all ahead on Film Week, right here on 89.3 KPCC. Hello, it's Film Week. I'm John Horn, host of KPCC's The Frame. I'm sitting in for Larry Mantle today. We have lots of new releases to cover for you heading into this weekend, as well as several that will be out next week for the Independence Day holiday. Then later on in the show, we're going to talk with our critics and an expert on Shakespeare about what makes a good film adaptation of a classic work of literature. But first, joining us to review this week's new releases are Claudia Puig. She's the president of the LA Film Critics Association and KPCC Film Week critic Lael Lowenstein. Claudia and Lael, welcome.
Thank you.
So we're going to start with Spider-Man Far From Home. And my math might be off, but I think it's the 479th installment in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Tom Holland reprises his role as the friendly neighborhood web-slinger. It also stars Zendaya, Jake Gyllenhaal, and Samuel L. Jackson. It's directed by John Watts. And if I have the timing right, it starts after Avengers Endgame? Do
That's
I have that right?
That's exactly right. You're right on all counts.
Okay, so what do you think?
Well, let me just back up a second and say that when the previous installment of this new reboot
so
came
this
out...
So this is Reboot 3, I think.
This is Reboot 3... And the sequel to Spider-Man Homecoming, I remember thinking, God, do I really have to go see another Spider-Man? Is this necessary? And I was so glad that I did, because this was a fresher, a reinvigorated, a much more energetic Spider-Man than I'd seen in a long time. And you know, we're going back to the Sam Raimi ones. The Tobey Maguire Spider-Man. We also had Andrew Garfield. We'd like to forget that chapter. this is British actor Tom Holland, who just brings this incredible kind of youthful energy, great sense of humor, and John Watts, the director of 500 Days of Summer, who came in and just brought really fresh eyes. As with others in the Marvel universe, the extended Marvel universe, there is an important sense of interconnectedness or kind of ability to read between the different Marvel films. That works in this case. It begins with a really sort of tongue-in-cheek in memoriam sequence to the Avengers that died.
Or did they?
Maybe they didn't. I don't know. Some did, some didn't. And then it also feeds into a high school news telecast of the explanation about the blip that happened during the 5-year period when half of humanity was wiped out only to come back.
So truly fake news.
Right. Fake. Exactly. What I love about this film is, much like the last one, Spider-Man Homecoming, it brings a relevancy, sort of a currentness, the whole fake news issue, there's a lot of, you know, don't believe everything you read on the internet kind of thing, or maybe you should. It's got Jake Gyllenhaal as Mysterio, possibly a hero, maybe not, who knows? And it's got great turns by Samuel Jackson, it's Nick Fury, it's got Kobe Smulders. It's got some terrific references to everything that we expect to see, but it's, again, it's that youthful freshness, and a lot of it had to do with that take on, you know, growing up. That Spider-Man is really, he's the goofiest of the heroes.
Is he still in high school?
He's kind of ish still in high school. I mean, it's
very
really
long.
He's going for his GED.
Yeah. And
graduation
also,
is overrated.
The really dry, sardonic, you know, supporting cast, Zendaya as MJ. I really like the way that the cast is peopled by, you know, not necessarily the classic cookie cutter people that we expect to see in these films, and so it brings it forward in a whole new way, and I think there's going to be a lot more life in Spider-Man.
You're gonna have to wait a couple days because this is a 4th of July release. It's in wide release starting on Tuesday. Spider-Man Far From Home stars Tom Holland, Zendaya. John Watts directed the film, written by Chris McKenna and Eric Sommer. It's rated PG-13 and wide release next Tuesday. Now we're going to talk about Midsommar. It's a horror film from writer-director Ari Aster, who also wrote and directed the 2018 film Hereditary. Florence Pugh and Jack Rayner star in the film. about a couple who traveled to Sweden for a village's midsummer festival, only they discover it's a little like the Hotel California. You could check out anytime you want, but you can never leave. Claudia, let's talk about Midsummer.
I really like this movie. It's. I will start by saying it's 2 hours and 20 minutes, but I was never for 1 second feeling the length.
I saw it last night, and I looked at my watch, and I said, I literally thought my watch was off by an hour because it went by so fast.
Yeah, no, we're probably at that same screening. I found it so unsettling and sinister. At moments it was a little uneven, but it was so watchable, and it gets under your skin in a creepy way. And the premise is fresh and freaky, and it's just disturbing. I thought Florence Pugh is mesmerizing. It starts in this really, really viscerally. It grabs you in because she experiences this terrible tragedy. So she's mired in her grief, and she's got this boyfriend who's really not a great boyfriend by saying it mildly. And he's this weird passive aggressive kind of guy. He's going off with his guy friends to Sweden. Yeah, his bros. And he sort of invites her to come along because he feels guilty because she's gone through this terrible tragedy, expecting her to say no, but she says yes. And nobody really seems to want her there. And things get worse from the minute they set foot. But it's so interesting because it's so bucolic and beautiful, and there's flowers, and there's these hippie-like people in these folk costumes. And so you just feel like it's this maybe, and there's eternal sunshine because it's a land of midnight sun, of course. And then it just gets so dark in this very bright way. And the contrast of that, I think, is fascinating.
I think there is an attention to detail in this film that's extraordinary.
Yes.
In production design, costume design, food styling. All those
tea?
Little things.
Mushroom.
Yes, yeah. There's like a kind of a Sweeney Todd kind of element about what it is that you're actually eating. The music is done by a composer named The Hacks and Cloak. The music is unbelievable.
The music is amazing. It really helps create that edgy feeling. You are not on the edge of your seat in the same way that you would be with a scare. I mean, I was never like frightened, but I was deeply unsettled, and it works. I thought it was better than Hereditary,
and
personally.
I think we also should say something about Florence Pugh, who I saw in Lady Macbeth in 2016. I mean, she is not old. I think she's 23 years old. She acts like a veteran.
Yes.
I think she has a bright future ahead of her. I think she's by far the best actor in the entire film.
She is.
And it really is dependent on her performance. And I thought.
Yeah, because you have Will Poulter, who's kind of in the bro mode, and you don't really care about him that much. And the boyfriend is just throwaway. It's really the production design, this sort of bucolic summer camp splendor, and these kind of, you know, sort of mild, smiling looking Swedish hippies. And, you know, it has such the tonal clash. What's going on underneath it is so fascinating.
And even though it's a completely fantastic made up world, you never doubt for a second that it is real. I mean, it feels like this place exists. And
yes.
I think that's Ari Aster's great achievement in this film. It does feel like this is a place that you could go visit.
It made me never want to go
not
to Sweden.
Not that you would want to. Yes, I know.
I've been wanting to see.
The Swedish Tourism Board is not going to be that happy about that. Again, it's a movie you're going to have to wait a little bit for. Midsummer stars Florence Pugh and Jack Rayner. Ari Aster wrote and directed the film. It's rated R for reasonable reasons, and it is in wide release starting next Wednesday. Now we're going to talk about a movie that may be a little less scary. It's Yesterday. It's a musical fantasy comedy. It's about a struggling musician who, thanks to this kind of global electronic grid thing, wakes up in an alternate universe where the music of the Beatles and the Beatles themselves and some other little things have never existed. Himesh Patel and Lily James star in the film. It was directed by Danny Boyle and written by Richard Curtis. Lael, what did you think of Yesterday?
Yesterday was not everything I wanted it to be, but it had elements that I really wanted. I love Danny Boyle, you know, Slumdog Millionaire, Trainspotting, 127 Hours. His films are so energetic and kinetic, and there's so much edge to them. And then to have Richard Curtis, who is the author of Notting Hill and Love Actually, films that have that wry British sensibility, I thought, what's going to happen when you bring them together? There was too much Richard Curtis and not enough Danny Boyle in this case. I didn't feel like it was a melding of the voices that went particularly well. It started out fairly strong, and it started out as a great conceit, but it ran out of steam. I felt like it didn't know where it wanted to go. And then there's a late sort of third act jumping the shark kind of a thing, where a particular character
it's
is introduced that really did not work for me.
You're talking about a visit with a certain musician who will not be identified.
No, we can't spoil that.
Okay.
But it just, you know,
it spoiled the movie for me.
It did for me as well.
I thought it did spoil it.
It had so much potential, and everyone I know wants to see this movie. You know, it's one of those, like, yes, it's going to be great. And yes, the music of the Beatles propels it forward and is highly enjoyable, but the trailer gave away most of the best gags.
It definitely did. You know, the conceit is clever enough. It's a high concept. It's this lightweight bauble, and there were some moments, like when they sang together, he and Lily James, they have a nice chemistry, and Himesh Patel has a nice singing voice, but it sort of made the Beatles repertoire sort of sound like kind of minimal or just sort of a lightweight in a way that it's not, because it was kind of like greatest hits kind of thing. I felt like it's intermittently charming. If you look too closely, it's not. And I totally agree. It had way too much Richard Curtis and not enough Danny Boyle. Richard Curtis in the worst. I mean, you know, I actually am a mixed fan of Love Actually. I loved Four Weddings and a Funeral. Notting Hill, not so much. But this feels like it's become kind of his formula, and it didn't work.
It felt sometimes like Himesh Patel was playing someone who was playing someone in a Richard Curtis film.
It was
way too self-aware.
I have one last question. This is kind of the morality of the story. It is kind of a Dear Evan Hansen device, where Himesh Patel's character, because nobody has remembered the Beatles music, assumes or pretends that he has written it and performs it. And it feels like it sets up a moral quandary that maybe it doesn't quite pay off, that he is, you know, a fraud because, and I think this is not spoiling anything, he is pretending this music is his own. And I'm not quite sure what you guys thought of whether or not he got his just rewards for pretending to be somebody he wasn't.
I feel like that was a problem. It let him off the hook. I mean, there is this moment where you think he's going to be found out, and it kind of goes in a different direction, which in a way I thought was sort of okay. I have a bigger problem with it, is that, you know, I kind of like to think of what does pop music, or what does music look like without the Beatles' influence? Mm-hmm. And it would have gone completely differently. At one point, somebody talks about Coldplay.
Oasis,
like,
I think.
Yeah. Right? But I mean, think about it. What pop music would be radically different without the Beatles' influence? Because people who've been either directly or indirectly influenced by them are legion. So it doesn't explore that, which I think would be really interesting. It's just like, it's just a gimmick. And I really wanted to like it more. I did like the music. I thought he sang well. I thought he and Lily James had nice chemistry, but it ends up becoming this really kind of silly love story by the end.
Yes.
And one thing I will say is Ed Sheeran plays an elevated version of Ed Sheeran. And that part of the movie I thought was very clever. Yesterday is the film. It's directed by Danny Boyle and it stars Himesh Patel and Lily James. It's rated PG-13. It's now in wide release. You don't have to wait for this one. And if you're interested in hearing more about the making of the film, you can check out my interview with Himesh Patel. It aired on The Frame earlier this week, and you can find it at kpcc.org/theframe, and we'll link it on the Film Week page as well, kpcc.org/filmweek. Okay, we did Midsommar, one scary film. Let's do Annabelle, another scary film. Annabelle Comes Home. It's the latest installment in the Conjuring universe. Gary Dauberman wrote and directed the film, his first in both categories. It stars Vera Farmiga, Patrick Wilson, Madison Iceman, and Katie Sarife. Claudia.
Well, if you like horror thrillers, I would advise going to see Midsommar and not Annabelle Comes Home, unless you really, really love the Conjuring universe. This is the seventh movie in the canon. I'm not sure it needed a seventh movie. I feel like it's pretty exhausted. It felt like in the old days we'd say made for TV, kind of disposable. It's set in the 70s. It had this Brady Bunch like house that became a house of horrors. But, you know, the production design was sort of interesting in that 70s way. But it ended up becoming kind of more a haunted house film than it was a scary doll story. And it's just a succession of scary stuff and kind of, you know, bumps and jolts, and it's not anything special.
Well, and I think that's an interesting comparison, because Midsommar, I think there's maybe one jump scare and it's a phone ringing very early in the film.
Yes,
and
yes.
Yet I think these kinds of movies, and I suspect this is true of Annabelle, have a lot more jump scares that maybe not be earned.
Yes. I mean, they rely on jump scares too much. And, you know, I liked a couple of the Conjuring movies, and Annabelle is a just terrifying looking doll. But and the fact that this is sort of loosely based on these, you know, famous paranormal investigators, unfortunately, Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga, who are the better part of this franchise, are absent for most of the movie. So it just doesn't work.
That's Annabelle Comes Home. It's the horror film from first-time writer-director Gary Dauberman. It stars Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson. It's rated R. It is in wide release. More film reviews are just ahead on Film Week. When we return, Claudia and Leo will tell us about Ophelia, a reimagining of Shakespeare's Hamlet, told from Ophelia's perspective. We'll also tell you about the drama Euphoria, starring Alicia Vikander. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle today. We'll be back with more of Film Week in just a minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn, in today for Larry Mantle. We're joined by critics Leo Lowenstein and Claudia Puig, who is the president of the LA Film Critics Association. Claudia, one quick thing. I think we should say Midsommar has the best and worst sex scene that I've seen in a movie in a very long time. Would you agree?
Yes. Oh, yes. It is one of the weirdest and strangest and unsexiest sex scenes you will ever see. Okay. With a lot of nudity, though.
Definitely. Yeah. Worth checking out. Now, let's talk about the documentary Maiden. It's a British film directed by Alex Holmes about Tracy Edwards, who in 1989 became the skipper of the first ever all-female crew to enter the Whitbread Round the World race. This is a 9-month race that covers tens of thousands of miles. The film features interviews with and archive footage of Edwards and her crew. I love this movie. I hope you guys did too. Lael?
Absolutely loved it. And what a revelation to me. I mean, I didn't know the story, and the fact that, you know, as of 30 years ago, women hadn't even entered into this race, let alone skippered a boat, let alone had an all-female crew. This was like the equivalent of having, you know, women enter the Citadel or something at this point. So Tracy Edwards was this young girl, sort of from a troubled home, like her, always getting into difficulty, and, you know, decided she had this dream. She wanted to skip her boat. She'd been a cook on this one ship and on this one boat, and decided, you know, gosh darn it, I want to do this thing. And so she gets this crew together. It reminded me a little bit of the Shackleton movie, Endurance, where there are the interviews, present day interviews with the women who were then, you know, quite young and really didn't know what they were doing, but just kind of had a dream and decided to pursue it. And it's intercut with this grainy archival footage, which is, you know, though the technology is sort of primitive, it's low res, you know, it works so well because you have this really you are there sense of being right in the middle of this boat and these waves in this daunting journey, which is really quite, I mean, it's quite stunning.
Well, not only is the technology primitive, the commentators and the other sailors are primitive
as
well.
Talk about primitive in their sociopolitics.
In terms
of
the misogyny and how they judge whether or not women could sail. I mean, Tracy Edwards, before this race, the only job she could get on a racing boat was as a cook.
Right.
So she could handle a spatula, but not a spinnaker.
Right.
And I'm not going to spoil anything. Let's just say that she shows some of these other men up in a big way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Claudia, what do you think of the movie?
I loved it. And in fact, it won the Audience Award at the Mendocino Film Festival,
nice.
Which I programmed. In which John attended this year. And it's worthy of so many awards. It is such a powerful story. I found it exhilarating to watch because I also didn't know the story. And I'm not a sailing fan particularly.
Right.
And I think it works just as well if you are
you
or aren't. It's inspiring. It's tautly edited. I liked the interspersing of the women as they are now and then the women when they were younger. And I loved hearing about her backstory. I thought it was really gracefully kind of juxtaposed. I liked the use of the archival material. I was completely engrossed in the story. It really celebrates the perseverance of a woman. It's a true feminist tale, even though she herself would not call herself a feminist back in the day.
She's asked, does she consider herself a feminist? And she says, well, no. And then towards the end of the film, it's a reimagining of what it means to be a feminist.
Exactly. And I like that they also didn't sugarcoat how harsh she could be.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, people were saying she was tough. She had this, you know, she would yell at people. She was stressed, understandably, because, you know, everybody, you know, was discrediting her and their whole effort. And I like those kind of backward glances. Mm-hmm. The only thing I would have liked to have seen was, we know she was a cook. We know she loved to sail, but we never really found out how she learned to actually sail.
Right.
And I would have liked a little bit on that.
Well, you can check out the interview that we did with her.
A little promotion
here. So we are discussing the documentary Maiden. It's from director Alex Holmes. The film is rated PG-13. If you have a daughter, take your daughter.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You can see it at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark Theater in West L.A. And if you want to hear more on the film from director Alex Holmes and Tracy Edwards, who is the subject, you can check check out my interview with them that we aired earlier this week on The Frame. You could find it at kpcc.org/theframe or at our Film Week page, kpcc.org/filmweek. Okay, another feminist story, Ophelia. It's a reimagining of Shakespeare's Hamlet told from the perspective of the play's female protagonist who, if you know your Hamlet, Ophelia doesn't do a lot in Hamlet. She just kind of watches as things unfold. Claire McCarthy directs the film based on the book by Ophelia by Lisa Klein. Daisy Ridley stars as Ophelia. Claudia, you want to start us on this?
Yes. She doesn't do a lot in the original, but she does do a lot more here. So this is a good week for female empowerment films.
Yes.
I would say that this is uneven. It looks beautiful. It's engaging. It's beautifully shot. It's sumptuous. It's, of course, a twist on Hamlet as seen through the female perspective. I think Daisy Ridley was good as Ophelia. I think Naomi Watts, who plays a dual role as Queen Gertrude and her sister, mm-hmm. who I don't think actually was in the original.
I don't think
no,
so.
No, I think they invented that, is quite good.
They invent a lot here.
Yeah, they do. Clive Owen had a very bad wig, but if you get past that distraction, you know, it's always nice to see him. I felt this, you know, it was a kind of a clever reimagining, rethinking. She certainly became a more proactive figure than she was in, you know, Shakespeare's version. And I don't know. I would have liked it to be a little bit more compelling because I felt like it sort of was strong in the beginning and then kind of
petered
meandered.
Out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
I think I liked it a little bit more than Claudia. I felt it was a particularly good example of how strong casting can work in a film's favor. Daisy Ridley bringing some of that spunk and grit that she is known for as Rey in the Star Wars movies to this role, and that working really well in her favor. Much as, let's say, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead by Tom Stoppard. It was a completely different take on Hamlet with two very, very minimal characters. This is a look at Ophelia as a protagonist, not, let's say, a very proactive, very motivated, very wily, and sort of thinking on her feet kind of heroine who is much smarter than she's given credit for. And I liked the idea of that. I liked seeing her be an agent for change, being someone who doesn't, let's say, end up where you think she's going to if you read the original.
Yeah. But I didn't really buy the romance very much, and it cribbed from Romeo and Juliet.
Mm.
And that, you know,
I wasn't as interested
in
the romance.
Marriage.
Yeah.
No, I was more interested in her kind of,
her scrappiness.
I thought they did a pretty good job of developing her character, but I thought the, you know, sort of by shoehorning the romance in, it kind of diminished it a
right.
little bit.
And I would say for people who know Shakespeare, there are a lot of little Easter eggs about lines from other plays mm-hmm. that are kind of dropped in there.
And Get Thee to a Nunnery is done a little differently. And
yeah, but we'll talk more about Shakespeare later. Ophelia is the film. It's written by Semi Chellis. It's directed by Claire McCarthy, and it stars Daisy Ridley. It's rated PG-13, and it's playing at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica, Lemley's Playhouse in Pasadena, Lemley's North Hollywood, and at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset. Now, Blue Note Records, Beyond the Notes. It's a documentary from writer-director Sophie Huber about the famous record label, which was home to musical greats like Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, and John Coltrane. Lael, why don't you start us?
This is a really good documentary. It does a excellent job of introducing you not just to Blue Notes as a label and to the history of it. I didn't know it was created by these two German guys who came over from Berlin, and because of their love of jazz, just
in the 1930s.
In the 30s,
fleeing from the Nazis.
And just exactly. And you know, perhaps it was their own sort of narrative that they brought with them, the whole persecution thing, and their love of jazz informed their ability to create and bring something new out, and so that's how they created this label, which essentially gave artists incredible freedom. The film does a really nice job of tying in the connection between jazz and hip hop. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of interviews with artists. One of my favorite moments was when Herbie Hancock is talking about working with Miles Davis and playing with him, and how incredibly freeing that was and wonderful. And they're just in the pocket. They're really feeling it. They're in the zone. And then Herbie said, "And I played this chord that was just the wrong chord. I knew it was wrong. I didn't know what was going to happen. I knew it was wrong." And then Miles just went along with it, and he took an accident and he made it into something kind of beautiful
because he didn't judge it.
He didn't judge it.
I love
it.
That.
And that
yeah,
was what
was
so great about Blue Note.
Claudia?
Yeah, I love what he was trying to say about don't judge yourself as an artist.
That's right.
I thought it was fascinating. And even if you're not a rabid jazz fan, and if you are, you're going to know, obviously, you're going to have known about the history of Blue Note Records. But I do think that the way they tied it together, of course, it's great to hear from Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter. But you also hear from newer hip hop artists and producers, and you find out like Kendrick Lamar's, you know, kind of newfound love of jazz. And how there was a really fascinating thing towards the end of the film, because it really tied sort of the link between jazz and hip hop and how the sociopolitical commentary and how it reflected the times. And one of the producers talks about how when he was young, there were music programs and people would carry instruments around. And when music programs ended in the schools, musicians were forced to turn to turntables. And that's how that began. And so there's all this like really interesting little tidbits about hip hop as well.
Right. The whole idea of improvisation,
yes.
of improvising with what you have available.
The creativity. Yeah. And I love that the sort of the notion that if we don't keep handing this down and if people aren't aware of what Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter and all these wonderful musicians did, that, you know, we need to concentrate on passing those lessons down. Mm-hmm.
Blue Note Records, Beyond the Notes is the documentary. It's written and directed by Sophie Huber. It's unrated, and you can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. As for Jane is a drama written and directed by Rachel Carey. Cody Horn, Allison Wright, Chloe Levine, and Sarah Steele are in it. It's about a group of women who team up to provide safe but illegal abortions in 1960s Chicago. Claudia?
Well, I was thinking about films like Vera Drake that Mike Lee did, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce the Romanian director's movie, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. And those are so compelling and sensitive in terms of how they approach abortion. They're really, and they're both directed by men. I would love to see a really good film about this subject directed by women. Unfortunately, this is not that. It is well-intentioned, and it's certainly timely. Could not be more timely. Mm-hmm. It's just not terribly well-made or well-acted. It feels a little bit kind of amateurish in its production values, and the script is a little clumsy. But it's so well-intentioned, I kind of hate to sort of rake it over the coals.
Lael?
Exactly. I agree with Claudia. It felt almost like you're reading a sort of sixth grade sex ed primer, in terms of the way it hit every conceivable cliche, basically, about, well, you didn't think you were going to get pregnant because he said he wouldn't. So, all that kind of thing. It just felt very sort of pat, very on the nose. Having said that, the fact that these women actually did create this referral service for women to have safe and safe abortions before Roe versus Wade. And that's such an important thing. And I don't want to minimize what that was. And especially given everything that's going on now.
I think a documentary.
That's the question.
Yeah.
Would this have been more interesting as a documentary
Absolutely.
As opposed to a narrative
Absolutely.
Film?
Yeah.
And why is that so?
Yeah, I wanted to see the documentary.
Because it's a real story, because it's so important right now. I mean, I guess you could, or you could have told the story in a slightly different way. But I there's a lot of films like that where I feel like I'd rather know the real story as mm-hmm. opposed to how you chose to interpret this story.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to maybe the fictional version of Maiden, which I think they're going to do, or Three Identical mm-hmm. Strangers, where you take a great documentary that should just exist on its own and try to make it into a narrative film, which seems often like a bad idea.
Yes.
The film is Ask for Jane. It's a drama starring Cody Horn, Allison Wright, Chloe Levine, Rachel Carey wrote and directed the film. It is unrated and playing at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. More just ahead on Film Week with the release of the film Ophelia, which we reviewed earlier today on Film Week. We'll take a look at some of our critics' favorite modern adaptations of Shakespeare's plays and other classic works. We'll also talk with a Shakespeare scholar about what it takes to make a good adaptation of a classic work of literature. I'm John Horn. I'm in for Larry Mantle. We'll be right back after this break. It's Film Week. Welcome back. I'm John Horn, sitting in for Larry Mantle today with critics Claudia Puig and Lael Lowenstein. We have one more movie to get to. It's called Our Time. It's a Mexican drama starring Natalia Lopez, Phil Burgers, and Carlos Regadas, who also wrote and directed the film. It's about a family living in the Mexican countryside, raising Fighting Bulls. Do I have that right?
That is correct. Yes. What it really is about is it's a 3-hour examination of marital anguish. And if that sounds like fun to you, have at it. You feel like you wandered into someone's couples therapy session and you're locked in there with them and you're desperately looking to find a way out. It's a painful experience. It's also beautiful to look at. So it's a really, it's a
mixed
bag.
You're not selling it.
No, I'm not. I'm not trying to sell it. It looks stunning. The visuals are epic and majestic. There's this one scene of a plane coming into Mexico City that is just, you know, gorgeous. But it feels too much like a solipsistic self-absorbed examination. It's played by the real director and his real wife, and there's, you know, speculation about what may have been going on in their marriage. I don't want to know. But they also have their children in it, and at one point, they're in order to explain sort of the psyche, you have one of the little children doing a very adult voiceover talking about infidelity and desire, and it just feels really off-putting. Unless you're, you know, Regadas is a fascinating director. He is polarizing, but this one did not work for me.
Our Time is the film. It's written and directed by Carlos Regadas, who also stars in the film alongside Natalia Lopez and Phil Burgers. It's unrated, and you can see it if you want at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A.
To be or not to be?
To be or not to be. To be or not to be.
That is the question as posed by Laurence Olivier, Kenneth Branagh, and Ethan Hawke in various film adaptations of Hamlet. But those movies, along with this week's Ophelia, are just a few of the many on-screen versions of Shakespeare's plays. In addition to being the most famous playwright of all time, Shakespeare may very well be the most prolific screenwriter of all time. According to our count, he's credited as a writer on more than 1,400 IMDb.com projects, and of those, more than 400 are feature films. And with us to discuss some of the most iconic Shakespeare movies is Robert Watson. He is a distinguished professor of English. I don't want to say that better. If it's, I'm talking about English, I should pronounce professor, right? Distinguished professor of English at UCLA and a Shakespeare scholar. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So let's say there's a limit to the amount of Shakespeare you can consume and you haven't been to the theater to see some good Shakespeare movies or gone to Netflix. What are, in your mind, the must-see adaptations?
So there's some that are very easy to get at. The Midsummer Night's Dream with Kevin Kline is charming. Much Ado About Nothing that Kenneth Branagh did is very charming. But I think there are also more challenging versions that are rewarding. I often recommend that people look at Kenneth Branagh's Henry V, which takes a history play, which would seem to be a little less juicy for people, and turns it into a really compelling understanding, not just of the politics that are going on in that period, but why they look like politics that we still face today.
One of the things that I think is often a challenge of adapting Shakespeare is depending on how quickly the actors are performing a play and how much has been redacted for speed. You know, a Shakespeare play can run 3.5 hours long. So when you're adapting a film, you're necessarily making a lot of cuts. And also, if you're being faithful to the material, you're doing it in iambic pentameter. For film audiences, what are the obstacles for them to get engaged in the story, and what do filmmakers need to do to make the story accessible to somebody who doesn't know the history and doesn't know the language as well?
Yeah, so that's always going to be a struggle, but it seems to me there are opportunities to use visual cues to let people see what kinds of transactions are going on between people. So the language isn't really – most of the successful adaptations I've seen are perfectly willing to let the language stay as it is, but to give visual reinforcements for it. I think some of the risks that come with that, though, are that it gets too easy to give the visual reinforcements to make things literal, to make them look realistic, whereas Shakespeare was working in a kind of metaphorical mode.
You talked about Kenneth Branagh and his Henry V. I'm going to ask you about Akira Kurosawa, who has also adapted Shakespeare multiple times, as has Orson Welles. So when you think about iconic directors and how they have done with Shakespeare, what are the kinds of movies that you think have succeeded well?
Right. So Throne of Blood is a personal favorite of mine. I think it's a fantastic version of Macbeth. It's compelling. It captures the deeper levels of the play, even though it can't have any of that language in it because it's in Japanese. The subtitles are sometimes a little bit comic for the famous So Fair and Foul a Day, if not seen. It just says, such weather. And you're supposed to go from there. But I think that's one of the really extraordinary successes of transforming Shakespeare into another mode and yet having it come through with real power.
And there are obviously some plays that are harder to adapt. And I think you cite As You Like It and The Winter's Tale. Is that because they haven't been married to the right filmmakers or because they are not as easily transferable to film as, say, Henry V might be?
So I thought As You Like It had the wrong filmmaker the first time because I think he was determined to give his wife the lead role and she didn't speak especially good English. So that became a limitation. I think As You Like It failed for Branagh because it's a play. This is a problem that goes through a lot of the films. It's a play that depends on the very fact that the stage is kind of blank and things are created by metaphor. And everybody thinks, oh, you had a fake Forest of Arden for the play. We can have a real Forest of Arden. That'll be better. But the play depends on the fact that you don't really know. It plays so much on the boundary between what's artificial and what's natural that that actually creates a problem. Even in the Helen Mirren Tempest, the question of how to make Prospero something. On the stage, you just know it's a person, a costume, and you're asked to imagine which way to interpret it. But if they can give you too much, they can give you exactly what they think it looks like, then the play becomes literalized in a way that closes down the audience's imagination.
So who do you think has done kind of the more interesting creative adaptations? I think you're a fan of Coriolanus and also of Julie Taymor's The Tempest, or not so much the latter?
Yeah, Julie Taymor's Tempest was good. It was lively. I thought it was interesting, but it's a play that's wonderful in the theater, and I have yet to see a version on film that I thought absolutely worked. But I think some of the adaptations that people have done creatively with it, you mentioned one. Who do you mention first?
Coriolanus.
Coriolanus, right. So there's a play. I can't imagine what the pitch meeting sounded like. This meeting, everybody's nasty. It's just ugly and swarming, and the fights all turn into sort of messy brawls that go nowhere. That's not a play that sounds like it's going to go anywhere. But by taking it in a modern context, but keeping the language active, by setting it in kind of Eastern Europe in a that gives you not the Rome you're supposed to be intimidated by as this grand classical thing, which it really wasn't in Coriolanus's time, but, one of a set of contested city-states and individuals having to find their way through the politics of that. It's extraordinary to me the way that film makes accessible the complexities that Shakespeare wanted to bring out and also the weird emotional investment you can get, even in characters you dislike.
So there's certainly the plays that you like as movie adaptations. What about your students? What do they look for, and what adaptations do you find are the most popular in the classroom are the same that you find yourself liking?
Yeah, there's a pretty strong correlation, but of course professors always assume that students only think the things they want them to think. But they do come in and they will talk to me about things that they've seen on film, things that they think are wonderful. And I think, speaking of the Hamlets we did before, more recently, the Benedict Cumberbatch Hamlet, the David Tennant Hamlet, I think were both terrific versions of play. In some ways, I think the Olivier really doesn't read for students anymore. But if I'm recommending a version of that, that's what I would say.
Before we take a little break, I want to ask our critics about your favorite Shakespeare adaptations. What come to mind and for what reason?
I'm just thinking of the Baz Luhrmann Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely.
It was.
I like the Franco Zeffirelli one.
I love the music in that one, of course. And, yeah, there were some iconic moments certainly in that one. But, I give Luhrmann credit for going out on a limb and absolutely reimagining something that was so much embedded in our literary history. So, and of course, West Side Story, another take on Romeo and Juliet.
I liked the 10 Things I Hate About You, sort of obviously the spinoff of Taming of the Shrew, and also Othello. That was, do you remember that one with us, with Julia Stiles? Actually, she was in both of those, so she was making a little career of that. And I did like Joss Whedon's version of Much Ado About Nothing. I thought that was clever. It was obviously a modern day, but I do like the adaptations, but when it comes to Romeo and Juliet, I'm still all about the Zeffirelli version.
You're all about the Zeffirelli. What about you in terms of Romeo and Juliet? How would you score them from your report card, your classroom score?
Right. So, Zeffirelli has fallen in love with Romeo and Juliet material. It's gorgeous. It takes a lot of the edge off. It takes away a lot of the kind of conflicts. But at least it used young enough actors that you could connect to it and find it romantic. When you had, the old version with Leslie Howard and Norma Shearer, and they're both in their mid-30s to mid-40s, that was a little hard to connect to. Baz Luhrmann, I think, is wonderful. It energizes the play without losing the story.
We'll be back in just a minute with more.
Maria, just met a girl named Maria.
It's Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn. I could sing along, but that would create whatever the equivalent is of zero ratings. I'm the host of The Frame. I'm in for Larry Mantle this week, and joining me are Film Week critics Leo Lowenstein and Claudia Puig, as well as UCLA English professor Robert Watson. He's our expert guest as we discuss what makes a good film adaptation of Shakespeare's play. We obviously just heard a little bit from West Side Story. Robert, I want to come back to you about West Side Story, probably the most famous reimagining of Shakespeare's work on screen. Let's talk a little bit about it and then maybe some other standouts that are loose adaptations. West Side Story, the Jets and the Sharks instead of the Capulets and the Montagues.
Yeah, and it was a very clever updating of it, and I think the music's terrific. I think there was an effort to blend kind of high cultural prestige, even with sort of Leonard Bernstein there, to create a kind of accessible musical that still had a certain kind of symphonic glory to it. So it was very captivating for people. It feels a bit dated now, I think, if you try to watch it, even with their assumptions about what cross-cultural tensions are. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was an interesting project to try to put that into, you know, New York, 1950s, and to assume that this could be a kind of allegory for any form of cross-cultural conflict, and at the same time invest people with the individual emotions that those characters bring.
And even if it's dated, I think it's soon coming back. Claudia, is that right? Is
it
there a potential?
Is. Spielberg is actually working on it right now. But I was going to say, the one thing that I thought is sort of still timely about West Side Story, and this has very little to do with Romeo and Juliet and more to do with current sensibility or sociopolitical climate, is that line that Rita Moreno, you know, when they sing I Like to Be in America, and she says, you know, everything's fine in America if you're a white in America.
Mm-hmm.
That still resonates. So that's you know, has occasional moments that really hit.
Lael, what about you? Were you a West Side Story fan?
Yes, I certainly recognize its shortcomings, and you know, for the most part, I think the music certainly still holds up, you know, terrific score and
great choreography.
Great choreography, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jerome Robbins, is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Check me on that.
You know, I think
the brown face thing was a little problematic.
Yeah, that was a bit, I mean, yeah.
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 So there
love Natalie Wood, but, you know.
Yeah,
yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
Not buy her as Puerto Rican.
No.
There are a couple other adaptations that I think listeners might be surprised to learn are based on Shakespeare. My Own Private Idaho, which is inspired by Henry IV and Henry V, and The Lion King, which has some Hamlet in it. And when you think,
a lot of Hamlet, actually.
Yeah, yeah. But when you think more broadly about how Shakespeare has influenced modern filmmakers, are those good examples or other stories come to mind?
Oh, I don't know. I don't have a whole list of those. I mean, certainly if somebody went to see Joe Macbeth, they wouldn't have trouble figuring out what's going on. But there are moments, things come out of nowhere. I don't know. You remember a film called Burnt by the Sun? It was a Russian film, and it turns out to be a really intense, compelling reading of Hamlet. So if you want to reach for something a little bit afar, that would be one to reach for.
And what about you guys? I mean, do you recognize in those films, My Own Private Idaho or The Lion King, that they are really kind of reworkings of classic stories that Shakespeare, if you believe Shakespeare wrote the plays, actually created?
Well, Shakespeare, I mean, he dealt in such classic themes and in such large themes that, you know, you could probably boil down lots of movies that deal in father-son issues or love or whatever and find some sort of Shakespearean connection. I think, you know, people are so influenced by.
I hadn't thought about the Lion King one until you brought it up,
yeah,
John. But
yeah.
It certainly, yeah, it certainly is. I mean, you know.
And that's coming out again.
Yes, yes, it is.
So, Robert, I have a question for you. My favorite Shakespeare play is Twelfth Night. I can't think of a good film version of Twelfth Night. Did I miss it? Didn't
yeah.
happen?
Yeah. There's a pretty good version. I think Adrienne Noble directed with, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name of the actress. She played the villainess in the Harry Potter movies.
The Pink Lady?
Yeah, she was in all of the Merchant Ivory films.
Oh, Helena Bonham Carter.
Yeah, Helena Bonham Carter.
Yeah.
If you look at that one, I think that one actually works. There's a very melancholic clown in it, but it actually is kind of haunting. And I wanted to throw in a word for one other favorite film adaptation. That's the 1950s science fiction movie Forbidden Planet, which takes off from The Tempest. And I think is sort of fun in the way an old science fiction movie is fun. But it also has a really intelligent reading of the play, which says that you can't really exercise superhuman power safely if you still have human frailties.
Professor Watson, I have another question for you about young audiences. In the late 90s and early aughts, there were a number of adaptations of Shakespeare that were aimed at younger audiences. Romeo and Juliet, Baz Luhrmann's version, we talked about. 10 Things I Hate About You. There's Oh, Get Over It. She's the Man, which is apparently,
I've skipped 12th Night.
It was cute in its
day. All right. It was all right. Yeah.
But do those movies work in preserving Shakespeare, or are they basically kind of commercial ripoffs that are just taking a good idea that's in public domain?
Yeah, I think sometimes they're kind of reaching out there, as you say, public domain. Also, this sort of gesture of sort of high culture brought in the way that makes it friendly for people. The studios maybe feel good about that, the same way that Toho felt good about, you know, making a samurai movie of Macbeth out of Into Throne of Blood. But I think in some ways it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity for teachers and students to reach across some gaps to each other and begin a conversation about the play, even though that's never a good enough end of the conversation.
And the other thing we haven't really talked about are movies about Shakespeare himself. And there have been some. Shakespeare in Love in 1998, Anonymous in 2011, and this year's All Is True. I can't think of any of those movies. I mean, Shakespeare in Love did win the Best Picture Oscar, somewhat bizarrely. But have there been movies that you think have captured anything about the creative genius of Shakespeare?
No, I think it all falls short for me. I mean, I thought Shakespeare in Love was a nice movie. I thought it worked pretty well. It was that endless quest people have to understand what's behind the genius rather than actually appreciate the plays themselves. But, and Gwyneth Paltrow as the dark lady of the sonnet seemed a little bit of an oxymoron. and even the scene at the beginning where he's crumpling up pieces of paper as a traditional way of signaling writer's block was unrealistic in the sense that paper was very expensive in Elizabethan England. But I thought that one worked. Anonymous, I'd almost rather not say anything about, because the whole Earl of Oxford thing drives me completely crazy. It was trying to claim that Shakespeare didn't really write Shakespeare, and the movie was a kind of a muddled mess for me on that, so I hope it sinks somewhere deep beneath the waves.
Okay, I'm going to put everybody on the spot a little bit. Not just Shakespeare, but a classic work of literature. I'm going to ask all of you if there's a standout movie, and maybe it's one that's lesser known, based on a great work of literature that you hold near and dear and that you would recommend to people listening. Lael?
I mean, Clueless, you know, based on Emma, the Jane Austen classic. It's still good. Alicia Silverstone still works it, and it's got a young Paul Rudd. It's pretty great.
I liked Cary Fukunaga's Jane Eyre. I thought he did a really good job with it. But my absolute favorite adaptation ever is The Sweet Hereafter, Adam McGuigan's version, Russell Banks's book.
Very good.
Just those two are so great.
Professor Watson, do you have a non-Shakespeare or even a Shakespeare?
No, I've got some non-Shakespeares. I mean, I thought the Orson Welles Jane Eyre was a great, compelling kind of gothic movie. But the one I'd throw in is a bit of an odd case is Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye, Raymond Chandler. Mm. I found that movie completely fascinating. As a sort of a newcomer to L.A., and I'd recommend that for anybody who's curious about it.
I'm going to say Merchant Ivory's Howard's End. That would be my pick. So that is it for Film Week. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle. Thanks so much to our critics this week, L.A. Films Critics Association President Claudia Puig, KPCC Film Week's Leo Lowenstein, and thank you so much to UCLA English professor Robert Watson. Have a great weekend. Larry Mantle returns to host Air Talk on Monday. Thank you again.